Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is May 22nd, 2019. As always, I ask you to visit my website, www.rushjournal.org, and to please donate to my work, which can be done via PayPal there. This is a job that I do full time. I've been doing this for 30 years. And, I think I've, you know, if anybody who has gained anything from this, or from my writings, which I try to, all of them, I try to give away for free, as much as humanly possible, to the extent that you've gained from it, please, try to keep me as independent as I am, which requires support from my listeners. That being said, today I want to talk about a Russian philosopher that doesn't get very much attention in English, although he should, Boris Vyacheslavsky, who died in 1954, who was one of the anti-communist exiles from the early Soviet Union. Doesn't get the attention that he does. Partially, I think, because of his difficulty. He worked with Nikolai Berdyaev for some time, in exile, but Berdyaev became far more famous. But Berdyaev also was, I think, was a bit more accessible than Vyacheslavsky was. Also, he didn't have a last name that few people can pronounce properly. The so-called white emigres, those driven from the Soviet Union after the victory of the Reds, created their own community in Western Europe and the United States, centering around, of course, the Orthodox Church. Vyacheslavsky did his dissertation on Johann Fichte, one of the German idealists that I've spent a lot of time in grad school reading. The University of Moscow did his dissertation on him in 1914, and he taught at the same place until the communists kicked him out in 1922. And then he, because the emigre movement had already created their own institutions, he became a professor at the Theological Institute in Paris. And ultimately, his work centered around the idea of God. A philosopher approaches it using the term the absolute. God is a concept for theology. The absolute is a concept for metaphysics. But the absolute being what it is, when you think of Spinoza's substance, which I was always very attracted to, again, substance is the God of mathematics. Something like the absolute can't be systematized. It's not an object among other objects. The absolute underlies everything that we do. It can't itself be rational. It's the ground of rationality. It's not irrational. It's the super-rational. It's that which reason requires in order to function. Proving God's existence is kind of silly. It's like trying to prove matter's existence, because it's not so much a provable entity rather than the requirement for there to be any rational proof at all. Now, you could strongly suggest his existence. I mean, DNA alone proves that there's a creator. But still, in approaching it that way, you imply the existence of an absolute. It's the source for reason and can't be cognized by it. It can't be exhausted by reason, but it can be revealed in intuition, which is a specifically Russian idea. Whenever we look at an object, no matter what it is, we have to abstract it from everything else. That everything else can't really be cognized because it's everything. But our intuition is aware of it. And we realize that in taking an object out of everything else and analyzing it, it's a bit artificial. But reason, unfortunately, has that problem. It can't cognize everything by definition, including the source of everything. So it's more limited, and so we have to take specific objects and we divide the world up into different fields and specializations, and that's simply how humanity is. But the essence of everything that we do because of this exists in relation to this absolute. One of Mr. Slotz's main issues was the idea of moral laws. Morality, whenever you reduce things to rules, you then set up a system of rewards and punishments. You can't, you know, follow God's laws, so to speak, then say to him, I've done everything I'm supposed to do, now you owe me salvation. That's the very reason why things can't be reduced to rules. Rule following is defeated, according to him, by irrational antagonism. Rule following creates either a punishment because you didn't do it, or reward because you did. Christianity has always rejected this idea, partially because the structure of our motivation is extremely complex. We're not entirely sure why we follow it or don't follow it. But we also have the subconscious to worry about. For any kind of moral ideal, which, by the way, is different from a rule, it has to take over the subconscious. Our instincts derive from there. Intuition derives from there. What we're conscious of is far smaller than what we're not conscious of, for the same reason that taking an object from the world around us is artificial. We intuit via our subconscious the fact that there is everything else that we're ignoring, and we focus on one thing. Psychology early on with Jung spoke about the idea of sublimation. Actually, Freud talked about sublimation. And what they meant by it, the simple idea in Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents, is that our instinctual drives, in his case, Eros and Thanatos, this lust and death, which is what drive us, passions that come from our subconscious, that drive us to do things which are not rational, have to be put under control, or else civilization can't exist. The process of putting it under control is sublimation. It's not so much repressed, but rechanneled. We realize we have to sacrifice these things for the sake of reason, because civilization has to be built. And so there's always this certain level of rechanneling. We're not getting what we want because we have to focus on the things that we need. But the subconscious is still the home of instinct and our drives. In Plato's division of the soul, it would be the passionate, acquisitive aspect of it. So the sublimation of Eros transforms our base impulses into higher thought. What it means morally is that abstract freedom then is rechanneled into a search for goodness. One of the reasons that we need grace for anything is that we have no control over the subconscious. The great fathers, I know, more modern fathers, like Brandon Chanoff, for example, has said that the demons possess the subconscious quite often. Sin derives from subconscious. Things that we do aren't necessarily being driven by reason. In fact, a lot of what we do isn't driven by reason. It's driven by the subconscious. Reason is conscious by definition. So Wojtaszlawczyk concludes that any notion of ethics that's Christian can never be an ethics of law, but an ethics of sublimation. If we were just to follow this abstract freedom, we would do nothing but sin. So we lead the ascetic life so as to rechannel those drives into something that's rational. Now, he was very concerned with Karl Marx. So many of these guys were being driven from the Soviet Union. And he really took Marx apart, as so many of these guys did, as excessively simplistic and really an abuse of Hegel. Now, Marx did not take very much from Hegel. He wrote a critique of the philosophy of right, which I've always thought the philosophy of right being the greatest work of political theory ever written, It was my master's thesis was to a great degree on it. I spent so much of my master's work on it in St. Louis. It could be, you know, it could be a lifelong work. And of course, I know the rest of his corpus. You never could really master Hegel. He's too difficult for that. But when you understand the political part of the phenomenology, which is very substantial, Marx certainly took from it. When Hegel died, Marx was 13, so there could be no personal connection there. But Marx attempted to simplify and vulgarize Hegel, and he hated Hegel really because Hegel was believed in the spirit. Marx rejected the idea of spirit altogether. And one of its lots of big problems with Marx is that his rejection of the spirit meant that he rejected the idea of creativity. Creativity is the absolute center of the economy, not labor. When Karl Marx talked about labor, he's referring to physical labor, labor in a factory or labor in the fields. The mental labor is being done by others. For Karl Marx, the impersonal, non-creative stuff is what Marx means by work. It's to be subordinate to someone. It's an alien task, and it serves someone else's benefit. So the movements that a worker goes through, the standardized movements, say, at an assembly line or in a factory, are not invented by the worker. It's invented by the engineer and the intellectuals who create the machine. And in turn, these are organized by owners and managers. And the owner, of course, created the enterprise and controls it. And you see this in Great Britain with the writings of W.H. Mallock. Is someone who really should be read more than he is. The anti-communist writer W.H. Mallock took Marx to pieces. Really, the only attention Mallock got was in Russell Kirk's The Conservative Mind. The point is, if it wasn't for the machinery and the technology of organization, the technology and organization, labor, as its uniform and impersonal force, couldn't produce anything. I know W.H. Mallock talks about Shakespeare writing a sonnet, labor would be the pen. Well, the pen didn't create the sonnet. Shakespeare did. And this is what Marx meant by labor. It's not just any kind of work. It's the work of the proletarian. And he never could quite figure out upper levels of labor, which really are creative labor. And they're not alienated, not because they control everything, because no one controls every aspect of the process, but because they're enjoyable and they're freely chosen. So it's really that only impersonal market labor produces and creates value is absolute nonsense. It's a lie. Now, what I'm taking from here, if it's a slot, is the crisis of industrial culture, which came out 1 year before his death in 1953. And one of the theses of that book is that there really is no difference between capitalist and Soviet Marxist industry. And not necessarily because, of course, Soviet industry was created by the West, but because all industry has to be structured the same way in order for it to be industry. And his big target here was the labor theory of value. In other words, the idea that the value of any given object, of any given commodity, is based on the amount, the duration, and the intensity of the labor that's put into it. And that's its value. Not necessarily its price, but its value. And it exists only because of labor. And of course, he absolutely vehemently rejects that idea. And most, you know, other great economists do. But creativity isn't labor. Labor is standardized. Labor is under the control of somebody else. Labor is inherently physical. Now, creativity can be physical too, but it's not primarily physical. The value of labor that's invested in something isn't valued in the product itself, but by the quality of the creativity embodied in it. You know, creativity, as he says, is the achievement of a goal with the help of some combination of methods. Now, I'm translating his work here. The sheer amount of labor in no way ensures either the achievement of the goal, whatever you're trying to do with your work, nor the invention of the means. That's a purely spiritual matter. Now, when you're buying and selling something, you know, you're just interested in you know, price. But that can't be manifest in or by a goal that you're trying to achieve, a problem that you're trying to solve. And this is what real creativity is about. But that is not provided by the impersonal labor of the proletariat, but by the personal creative technique on the one hand and the organization of work on the other. So as both Vyacheslav and Malloch say, is that physical labor, the labor of the proletariat that Marx talks about, is a relatively small piece of the puzzle in terms of value. But really, most Marxists, you know, when they're pushed on the issue, have to say that the labor theory of value, which is the absolute core of Marxism, is really only limited to mass manufactured goods. But Marx himself admitted that it's not really applicable to any kind of monopoly. It's not applicable to rare items, and certainly not applicable to anything that takes a tremendous amount of creativity to create or invent. But rarities, things that are rare, always belong to monopoly owners, and they set monopoly prices. If something belongs to only one owner, then it has no competitors. In fact, he makes the point that all modern economic life is permeated by monopolies. When a small group of competitors owns a product and doesn't lower prices by their agreement, it acts as a monopoly. The legal prohibition of free competition, as you'd have in the Soviet Union, creates a monopoly. Monopoly is created by any concentration of production by, you know, by like a cartel or a trust or any other kind of association that reduces competition. Even in science, they recognize the price of all goods, which really can't be multiplied arbitrarily for a monopoly price. For there's in the hands of a limited number of owners who are not afraid of competition. But Marx even expands the concept of monopoly. He talks about monopoly capital all the time, because they own the tools of production. And that gives them the opportunity to squeeze even more surplus value. The idea of surplus value also at the core of Marxism. But of course, surplus value has to do with the labor theory of value itself. But it implies that where a monopoly acts, the labor theory of value isn't applicable. And therefore, it's applicable in huge areas of modern economy. It's inapplicable in capitalism and in communism, in Leninism, I should say. I'll repeat a point I've made many times before. The Soviet Union was what Marx had in mind. Karl Marx didn't spend a lot of time talking about what the future society would look like, which is very odd. Because every other socialist, including the Christian and idealistic socialists, people like Proudhon, for example, who was not a Christian, but he certainly was an idealist, spent a lot of time talking about what the new society was going to look like. You have to know what you're fighting for. Karl Marx didn't. And the reason is because he knew how unattractive it was. If you reject competition, then by definition, you have a command economy. There's only two options, at least for a modern industry. The notion of a command state-run economy is the only thing that a Marxist has to accept. So Leninism is Marxism. And the reason that Marx didn't talk about the future is because he really couldn't. And the dictatorship of the proletariat is quite sufficient. Engels went a little bit further than that. But when you destroy competition, when you destroy the private ownership of capital, when you destroy creativity, all you have is a state ownership of everything, and that's simply the only other option there is. But the labor theory of value, which is the absolute core of Marx, is utterly false. But socialists always kind of stubbornly hold on to it, even when Karl Marx himself had problems with it. It's not explained by any kind of theory, but Vyacheslav makes a very good point that it's really more about agitation and propaganda than economic ideas. If labor is the only source and the only measure of economic value, then the proletariat is the only producer of any kind of economic benefit anywhere. Therefore, the rest of the population, which he calls the bourgeoisie, doesn't work. They're idlers and parasites who use the labor of others. Now, to the extent that that's, you know, that's mostly not true, since it has nothing to do with creativity, has nothing to do with freedom, has nothing to do with the benefits of organization, none of which is labor in Marx's sense of the term. But when you're trying to propagandize a group of people, telling them that they're the only reason that anything exists, and therefore they should own everything, is good propaganda. And that's really why they hang on to the labor theory of value so much. Not to mention the entire theory rises and falls with it. But more importantly, this is how you get people to come onto your side. But whenever it happens, of course, all surplus value is taken by the state in communist countries. This is what we mean by, you know, socialism and communism are two very different things. Not in Karl Marx, but the way that it's developed in the 20th and 21st century. Communism is pure state planning and state ownership and state control. Socialism is far more broad than that. There were many forms of socialism before Marx, but because Marx had his hand in the Rothschild purse, he had the power to completely eliminate, as he did in the First International, all other competing forms of socialism. So referring to socialism has nothing to do with Leninism or Stalinism. But Marx also likes the idea of constantly saying that his view is scientific. But the fact is that most of what he does is outside of the sphere of scientific and real critical thinking. It's just mass psychology for a demagogic victory. So he taps into the tendency of the working people, that is to say the proletariat, to recognize only manual labor as genuine work and all kinds of spiritual creativity not really genuine labor, almost like it's, as he would say, privileged entertainment. So the labor theory of value really contributes to the strengthening of this prejudice. Then he would argue that the only source and measure of value is the proletariat itself, the average worker. And if you instill into common workers that their daily physical labor is productive, and all spiritual and mental labor is unproductive, then you get the demagogic lies built on a foundation of economic absurdity, and you end up with the Communist Party. But the truth is, without taking away from physical labor, it can't produce anything without spiritual creativity to give it orders. A pen doesn't write novels, the author does. So in no sense does the proletariat, in Marx's sense of the term, have any right to look at, you know, creativity or mental work as a kind of privileged bourgeois class to be destroyed. On the contrary, representatives of labor are a constant debt to creative individuals who have that very strange spiritual initiative. Successful invention can infinitely increase the productivity of labor, reduce the cost of its product, make it genuinely accessible, and increase the welfare of the nation as a whole. And on the extreme versions of this, you know, Gutenberg or Watt or Edison or Marconi, how much do they deserve? How much unpaid wealth or unrequited wealth did they bestow upon society? Typography has made human thought accessible to everyone. Everyone uses a telephone or a telegram or steam, electricity, radio, cinema. Labor didn't produce these things. Creative invention is always aristocratic and individual, at least according to its source. But it's democratic according to its results. No reward, no privileged position, as he would say, can ever really compensate for spiritual creativity. Because the full product of that kind of labor is infinite. And this is really the main reason that the labor theory of value is nonsense. And this applies to artistic and scientific and technical genius. Marxists have a tendency to even deny the existence of technical genius. Beethoven continues to be heard. Pushkin continues to be read. Newton continues to be cited. But what do they deserve? No privileged position could ever compensate for what they've done. The full product of labor is infinite in this respect. So what Karl Marx did is completely change the notion of work. But he did it primarily for the sense of agitation. You know, his theory, when you hear about it for the first time, is deceptively simple. All value comes from labor. Therefore, labor deserves to control all the value that they create. Problem is, creativity is not labor in Marx's sense of the term. It's not standardized. It's not immediately found in a product. It's not based on any kind of regularity. It's purely free initiative. Creativity is not mere work. Work is necessary to bring creativity to fruition, but that has the same relationship as the pen to Shakespeare. So we assume that every object, every commodity that's created, contains all the previous labor that exists necessarily for its creation. To make a thing, you need a complex machine. To make this machine, you need another machine. You need a whole system of machines, to infinity. To make a tool that's used for production, you need another one, and so on. And you go back to the stone axe. So if that hadn't been invented, then civilization wouldn't exist. Therefore, any commodity can never be measured by the amount of labor expended on it. Because for everything, this quantity is infinite, and therefore immeasurable. Marx will say that the worker during the week will produce more value than is necessary to maintain his existence. This, again, is very, very central to Marxism, especially in the first part of Capital. He receives this license to exist, so to speak, in the form of wages. And wages, in a certain equilibrium, you know, essentially covers his existential minimum. And in his theory, the iron law of wages, the capitalist is always trying to promote or to bring wages down to the point, to the minimum necessary to maintain the worker's existence. Now, of course, the worker creates a heck of a lot more value than that. So where does that value go? It's appropriated by the capitalist, who takes away from the worker a considerable part of his toil. And this is, again, there's lots of, I'm translating them here. A capitalist buys, rents a worker, say, 12 hours. And let's say the necessity of him being able to live is the wages he gets for 6 hours. And that's the price that the worker gets for 12 hours. That means he paid him the real exchange value of his work, according to labor theory of value. For the remaining 6 hours, the worker creates value that exceeds what's necessary to maintain his existence. The surplus value created by the surplus work doesn't go to the worker, but it goes to the capitalist who gets it for nothing. Now, Marx considers this his greatest discovery. So Marx identifies surplus value with exploitation. The number of workers in a factory and the amount of surplus value determines the amount of exploitation and the degree of exploitation. But it also means profit. And he thinks that, he was the one who exposed this for the first time. There's no discovery here. John Stuart Mill had created it. Ricardo had created it. And even Adam Smith mentioned it. Note that Adam Smith condemned this approach to economics. Adam Smith condemned the conglomerate, to the extent that they even existed at the time. He condemned, what we would call today the multinational corporation. But for Marx, economic materialism, historical materialism, are just as meaningless as dialectical materialism. Because economics and materialism are as incompatible as history and materialism. This is something that a lot of the white immigrants from Russia, Bulgakov is another one. Materialism, that is to say that everything that exists comes from some material reality, matter. Materialism can't understand or justify neither economics or history, because economics is spiritual. Now, what he means by spiritual here is something that we've spoken about some time, and the proof of the spirit is in free will, reason, and consciousness. None of these are material. Our thoughts don't follow any obvious cause and effect pattern. That means they're free. Technology is through spiritual creativity. The organization of labor is through spiritual freedom. And history, therefore, is through spiritual freedom. Now, freedom, in the sense that most people use the term, is available only to the few. No one is born free. We're all born completely dependent. Dependency is comfortable. To be free is to be completely rational, to be autonomous, to be free not just from external constraint, but internal constraint, or the subconscious and the passions that derive from it. That's very difficult. No one is born that way. It is so easy to be dependent. Dependency means that you don't have to think very much. Dependency means you're not really responsible for what you do. Dependency is a certain kind of privilege. I've said this many times in writing and on this show, but a beautiful woman has no reason to become intelligent. Why should she be free when she knows she's going to be taken care of? Why, you know, work hard in school when she knows that she can get by in a million other different ways? There's a very good reason where it's very rare to find a dirt poor beautiful woman, and certainly never a homeless beautiful woman. They simply don't exist. But life, which is lots of, means something a lot more than the working out of this cause and effect. A social being is a being of conscious persons, and they're acting on specific goals. It's not nature in the sense that science determines it. It's not matter. Spirit fights matter. One of the reasons that we know, and actually Plato makes a point of this, that our soul has different parts to it, so to speak, is that we know how to make war on our passions. What is that part of us that makes war on the passion to do something, or this drive to do something? When we, for example, trying to lose weight, we want to eat something, but we keep ourselves from doing it. Well, that means there's more than one principle acting in us at the same time. And the fact that we could cognize all of this and understand all of this in universal terms proves the existence of the spirit. Well, spirit has to have a source, and it can't be matter. Therefore, the absolute is absolutely necessary. Otherwise, you can't have thought. You certainly can't have truth without freedom. You can't have reason without freedom. Reason only makes sense when you're autonomous. Otherwise, it's just rationalization. So we're certainly not talking about every living person here. And as time goes on, this gets worse and worse and worse. We're really free, reasonable people are a tiny minority. But Vyacheslav talks about a social being, or species being, as Marx used to call it, for him, is a social consciousness, the collective spirit that determines the conditions of its own existence. And of course, that has a lot to do with nationalism. It's a collective unconscious that derives from genetics, derives from many centuries of experience of one group of people like a family. But what does materialism have to do with any of this? Certainly, metaphysical, mechanical, epistemological materialism is simply nonsense. But the only thing that produces value is this kind of public consciousness, social creativity, in the production of material goods. But a society that's dedicated to the belief that materialism is all that exists, and that therefore labor is the only thing that creates any value, creativity will be something that is condemned. And freedom is something that is condemned. People are suspicious of it. But by social being, species being, Marx meant the material life of society. And also he meant by that is the process of production and distribution, the economic process. Yet what he doesn't understand, and even capitalists don't understand, is creativity is at the center of all of this. It's at the center of the product itself, as well as the organization. Setting a goal for yourself, a problem to be solved, something to be overcome, can't be material. Because that sets means, a thought and imagination, and from this conscious approach, transforms material. Labor and creativity is an action that proceeds from the subject and changes the object. You see this in Bulgakov as well. And it makes a mockery of Marxism. It makes a mockery of postmodern capitalism too. But anyone who denies this, you end up then having to reduce everything to a regularized action of a material object. You have to deny the leading role of ideas. Material life only sets tasks, but these tasks are solved only by ideas and theories and political will, the spiritual life of society. Material life is not a subject, it's only an object of influence. So it's completely wrong that the material life of the society exists independently of the will. It consists entirely of will, of targeted actions, as he would say. And the whole point of socialism is the material life to be wholly subordinated to the organizing will, the organizing, mobilizing, transforming idea. The concept of reflection is something important in Marx. The life of the society is just reflection of its material reality. It's not true that ideas, theories, political convictions only reflect social being. They deny this being. They require another revolutionary struggle with being to transform it. If the production process is nothing more than a struggle with nature, a struggle with inert matter, then what kind of reflection could there be? Reflecting doesn't mean to fight and transform matter. All the philosophical helplessness, the theory of reflection, appears in this naive lack of thought. Now, by reflection, Marx is saying that theory, ideas, the dominating conceptions of a society are nothing more than a phenomenon of its material organization. Certain ideas in advanced capitalism, for example, can only exist in advanced capitalism. The foundation of a society is its material organization, and that produces the theory, the religion, the ideas of the mass as a whole. And therefore, ideas and theories derive from material things. And this is what Vyacheslav and so many idealists are fighting. In other words, social consciousness is nothing more than a manifestation of the economy. Historical materialism is the least inclined to turn human history into something that could be contemplated. Is a materialist understanding of history possible? Can history even be compatible with materialism? The concept of reflection means that the ideas that we have derive from labor's battle with nature. Nature has this material oppressive force that has to be transformed by work. So the material world creates this secondary nature. But Karl Marx can't talk about consciousness, because consciousness is not a material thing. It takes into itself material things and can arrange them. So history, of course, is the creation of a minority, a creative, self-determining group, and certainly can't be reduced to matter. History can't be pure naturalism. Because if he recognizes the organizing, the transformative role of an idea, he has to remove any kind of materialism from himself. So Marx, by definition, and Lenin and all the rest of them, can't talk about this stuff. This is why they reject metaphysics. Marxism is essentially positivism. And certainly utilitarianism. Being which is created, cognized by history, is not some aspect of matter. It's a social being. It's a being of a creatively acting and creatively organized subject. This isn't materialism. The only thing that can be reduced to materialism is work, in the sense that Marx refers to as labor and the proletariat. But for Marx to say this is real humanism, and saying that the true reality and true value is only this collective working group, And it's a way that Marx transforms Hegel's absolute spirit into the real, a real man on the basis of material nature. But he doesn't understand that in order to fight nature, by definition, man has to have a spiritual side. That which isn't spirit can't fight nature, it would be nature. And they can't explain what is it that wants to dominate matter, what is it that wants to recreate it for the sake of human society. Now, I'm not talking about the replacement of nature that industry, the Kabbalah, maintain. I'm not talking about that. But human beings rearrange things for the sake of making our lives easier. That's not to replace them. It's just putting them in the service of humanity or in the service of reason. When you take all of that into consideration, what's left of materialism? Well, all that's left of materialism is the pen that is used to write a sonnet. You can't eliminate idealism. You can't eliminate the spirit. But of course, at the same time, the human person isn't just spirit. We're not monophysites here. Matter does matter. Matter is important. We're both. The Gnostics rejected matter for the same reason that you see in the Kabbalah, the idea that matter needs to be replaced. It needs to be fixed. But Marx, even, you know, in certain moods, he does have to say that this primordial curse of material slavery is eliminated by the creative spirit. Whether it be science, in its true sense, technology, art, organization, even politics, derives from the spirit, but it's not a detached spirit. The spiritual personality, the individual collective, contains all the lower and subordinate stages. So, of course, it has to take into itself the physiological, the chemical, the organic, and then the mental. But the point of Plato's work is to see that reason has to organize these under itself, not replace them, not to destroy them, but to organize them and to infuse them with reason itself. But Marx couldn't really understand this. And this is why Hegel was so far superior to Marx. History is spiritual. History is spiritual through and through because it's a person's self-creation and self-determination. Yeah, people make their own history, but they don't do it arbitrarily. Of course, creativity has to work on previous realities. It doesn't start from zero every time. The spirit of man is creativity, but he doesn't create out of nothing, of course. Say that a person himself is the actor of his own historical drama, means to acknowledge that history is spiritual creativity. Now, Marx wants to say this. He has to say this, but he doesn't. So a materialist may ask, what is the spirit that you're talking about? We're not talking about ghosts. We're not talking about some detached entity. We're talking about something that determines the whole life of a person. Since Hegel, who really was the first philosopher of culture, spirit is that which organizes nature, organizes the material work around him. Morality, politics, these are the science of the spirit for Hegel. The kingdom of freedom is the kingdom of the spirit. It's a way to rise above necessity. You can't talk about freedom in the true sense without talking about spirit. You can't talk about reason without talking about spirit. Spirit is necessary to outline what Descartes would call thinking, or what Kant would call inner experience. In Marx and Engels, the fundamental opposition is expressed in a very ambiguous, non-philosophical concept of consciousness and being. But he really can't talk about consciousness very much, although he tries to. The opposition of Descartes and Kant is justified by the fact that the inner and outer worlds are two categories that can't be reduced to one another. But the categories constantly appear before us whenever we talk about creativity. It's a category of consciousness and action, goals and means, assessments and obligations, and then rights and morals. The spiritual life of society is as real as material life. Dialectical materialism doesn't find any better term, except, of course, for spirit. Culture and civilization, as he would say, embraces the whole system of human labor and creativity, the whole system of various forms of activity, like technical, scientific, economic, political, artistic, religious, and ethical. All these different directed activities don't stand indifferently together, but they condition each other. They represent a system of interaction. Though historical economism asserts that economic processes are the prime mover, in fact, the only reality, as Marx would say, and they condition everything else. The conditionality of determining, it's only one, you know, he says it's the only condition of possibility here. But what can be learned from this? I mean, the concept of reflection in Marx is absolutely essential, that our ideas derive from the basic organization of production. So can the production process determine the nature of society? And he says, for example, it isn't true, because a slaveholding economy, which Marx puts really as one of the most primitive, existed pretty much in the same way in Greece and Rome and Egypt, Judea, Babylon, even America, and many other places. It was equally engaged in agriculture, cattle breeding, and pretty much used the same tools before the invention of modern machines. Now, what does this tell us? Well, it tells us very little, because those cultures with the same economy don't have very much in common. Those societies have very little in common. Therefore, the reflection theory of Marx has to be false. The fullness of life disappears. Things like love and family, even power. All of this disappears, and certainly the individual disappears in any true sense, or the person, I should say. The history of producers, material goods, and the history of the working masses, for example, is all Karl Marx can talk about. But clearly, slaveholding societies have very similar economies, and yet otherwise have very little in common. It's impossible to reduce the wealth of any concrete reality to just one condition of its possibility. And he mentions, just like in the Shakespeare example, Liszt's compositions is due to the fluency of its fingers and the presence of an instrument. That has nothing to do with what someone like Franz Liszt is going to produce. To say that the building of a house is due to the production of bricks has nothing to do with architecture, because architecture is a matter of the spirit. What Marx does, and what capitalism does, especially in the postmodern sense, is to reduce everything to the lowest common denominator. Marxism can argue that it doesn't deny the higher sphere of spiritual life. It does not deny that there is just as material life is the only thing that exists. But I don't know what Karl Marx could ever use the concept of the spirit. They would just say maybe that spiritual life is secondary, or that it derives from the primary world of work. But what does he mean there? He can only mean that something like bricks are primary and construction is secondary. That the instrument, the tool is primary. For example, the instrument that makes music is primary and the musician is secondary. The tools of production are primary, but the person who invents them is not. And that ends up with absurdity. That's the closest that Marx could come to answering this kind of thing. That, you remember, materialism isn't just that everything is material, but everything that exists at least derives from that which is material. Therefore, he would have to say that the brick is the primary reality, architecture is secondary. Which, of course, is absurd. Bricks would have no meaning without the theory of architecture. Only the spirit can produce gold for itself. All Marx can talk about is method, is means. The only actor in history is the spirit. The spirit, the subject, turns matter into raw material and makes it a means for its own purposes. So let him define socialism, really, and this communists don't want to talk about this very much, but monopoly state capitalism. First of all, because the construction of socialism really requires a transformation of the whole country into a single factory. Lenin made it very clear, as did Trotsky, that this is the purpose. the globe is to be reduced to a single factory with single accounting method, single method of production. It's pure centralization. But when you're a materialist, this is the ultimate goal. So how can they talk about monopoly capitalism when Lenin is talking about the principle of economic calculation and the principle of profitability? The monopoly of domestic foreign trade, organization of credit, and everything, one bank that excludes all the others. Of course, Lenin is right. Socialism is state capitalism. But how is this, when you apply this to the interests of the whole nation? One thing that Marx and Lenin never talked about was happiness. Because in communist states, they don't just take away surplus value, they take away all value. And this is what caused the famine of 1919, 20, the 30s, the 40s. This is what collectivization meant. When you reduce everything to economic materialism, you get collectivization. And this is absolutely essential to understand. But Marx defines capitalism as dominated by a powerful industry, industrialization, electrification, huge instruments of production, accumulation. Industrial capitalism is the accumulation of capital through the withdrawal of surplus value, or surplus product. Without that, no industrial production is possible. And the taking of surplus value through the monopolization of the instruments of production. But all of those are three basic properties of capitalism, and they're fully present in communism. That's why it's state capitalism. This is the economic theory of Marxism-Leninism, because everything is determined by the instruments of production. Communization is due to industrialization. The highest level of communism would be the highest degree of industrialization and capitalization achieved by science and technology. But that's obligatory only for Marxism, only for economic materialism. There is no room for freedom here. There's certainly no room for truth and justice here. There's no room for anything, including happiness, here. And this is the essential point that he's trying to make in terms of economic theory. Ultimately, what it comes down to is advanced capitalism and socialism really is just a change in ownership. But briefly, let's get back to the idea of sublimation, because this is all connected here. Someone like Marx, including Smith and Locke as well, and Mill, also remove the concept of spiritual creativity. Mental illness, all mental illness, in fact, derives from delusion. A neurosis is not really about the will. It has to do with contact with reality. Mental illness is delusion, the belief that something is there when it's not, or something isn't there when it is. Spiritual sobriety rejects any concept of singleness, any kind of reductionism that everything is reducible to one entity. So what we would call cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, in Vyacheslav, does nothing more than expose the real for what it is. Karl Marx has no use for the subconscious. He can't make any sense out of the subconscious. Everything for him is conscious because everything is simply based on basic desires that are solved in the production process and absolutely nothing more. The symbol, the icon, is something that's used to bring the chaos of the subconscious into some kind of order. And Marx fetishizing labor really does derive from a subconscious drive. This notion that labor actually makes anything is the attempt to deny the subconscious altogether. And the truth is, and this is one thing that Nietzsche said that was correct, that spiritual things, if really the will has to be spiritual to be free, has to do with geniuses. It has to do with those few people who are actually free. A genius is someone who is completely free. And this is why geniuses often are bizarre people. We call them crazy. And they're rarely rewarded in society. For Nietzsche, the great man spends a lot of time alone. He's often hated. He's considered crazy. He's considered eccentric. And he tries to sever himself from society as much as possible. Marxism and capitalism have no reason for this guy to exist. He's crazy, so he needs to be institutionalized and drugged up and whatever it is. But that mentality comes directly from the labor theory of value. I'm not even saying that capitalism rejects the idea. It doesn't. Now, it's true that modern capitalism does have a group of parasites and idlers who own a huge amount of the capital. That's not what Marx meant, though. What Marx meant was that the bourgeoisie are those who live according to what we would call free will. Because the intellectual is not really a worker. And this is something that even communists don't want to talk about, because it was a huge error for Marx. And some neo-Marxists, of course, will deny this altogether. Really, the only place where the labor theory of value might work is in Adam Smith's Perfect Competition. Perfect Competition is his view of the state of nature. In Perfect Competition, the product is identical. There's a small group of producers sellers and buyers. The producer and the seller are the same person. And there is perfect knowledge. In other words, the buyer is 100% aware of the actions of the seller. There is no corporations. There's no conglomerates. There's no media. That's perfect competition. And really, the way that Marx would interpret this is to have a single global factory with identical repetitious movements to create a product, completely non-differentiated. To reject creativity is to reject the spirit. To reject the spirit is to reject genius. To reject actual, true production. Tools have no purpose without creativity. Lenin demanded profitability from nationalized factories. But that profitability was always taken away through direct taxes. It's not the destruction of profit. It's not about returning surplus value to labor, but about the distribution of surplus value among all factors of the industry. Marx's concept of unpaid labor was the main issue with capitalism. The campaign slogan, continually repeated, the sophism of unpaid work and the purchase of labor power was dialectically unraveled. But it contradicts Marx's own theory of value. It's clear that there is no unpaid work. Rather, it's paid by providing the entire grandiose intellectual apparatus. Every society that exists has to create surplus value, because that's what goes into the creation of greater and greater industrial enterprises. The worker necessarily pays for the use of the already constructed machine, without which he can't produce anything. And that's how he pays for his surplus labor. So Marx argues this: without wage labor, without machinery, equipment, instruments of production, capital can't produce anything. Therefore, everything is produced by labor. But this really can be reversed. Without capital, without a machine, machinery, the instruments of production, labor can't do anything. At best, she can maintain her miserable existence. Surplus product, and with it, the whole civilization and culture depend primarily on instruments of production. Surplus value is produced primarily by the creators of the constructive apparatus, technicians, inventors, scientists, with the participation of the workforce. The size of the surplus product does not depend on labor, which really changes very little. In fact, it decreases throughout history, but only on the perfection of the industrial apparatus. Those who invent it manage it. It really doesn't depend on labor at all, but on creative work. There is no unpaid work. There is only unpaid creativity. And this is the concept here. And this does derive from the subconscious, things that ordinary people don't understand. The share of creativity and invention and the creation of all that exceeds simple maintenance of life No one ever pays the genius for what he does. There's no unpaid work. There's only poorly paid work. Qualified work is valued more because it is rare and contains some element of creativity. Now, Karl Marx admits that in terms of rare objects, the labor theory of value fails. But great creativity and great genius is extremely rare. And Mr. Slotsev believes and that this is really the only real source of value. And this is the concept here. Conglomerate and capitalism can soak up all the available capital, import slave labor, manipulate local governments. They also have the power to dominate suppliers to the breaking point. But it doesn't make any difference whether the state owns this or private capital owns this, because industry also always has to be run the same way, and bureaucracy always has to run the same way. So to summarize it, the striving for simplistic monism is everywhere. But if an actual thinker is always connected with subtle and complex work of thought, striving to reduce all the concrete riches of life to one favorite category, that is work in this case, it's really about, you know, semi-intelligent people who need a simple and accessible worldview to simplify the inability to see the complexity and the richness of being, and it leads to the impoverishment and the vulgarization of consciousness. That vulgarization is a proletarian outlook of Marx. It wants to conceal the poverty and boredom of its monosyllabic dogma in multi-volume and multi-million editions. And it requires really only to the average person that they don't have to think. They've already thought about it. They've already unlocked the key to history, or they have the key to history, and they've unlocked it, and it's nothing more than themselves. But if the dialectic of history promises to destroy classes, then it must also destroy the proletariat, and with it the proletarian consciousness and worldview. The USSR was true socialism. No socialist can believe in the free market, since the market for labor was Marx's main problem, trying to drive wages down. The socialization of the instruments of production is an expression that doesn't mean anything. It can mean nationalization, but it could also mean collective ownership. But collective ownership is something opposite to state capitalism. Workers themselves, rather than the state, being owners and capitalists, their enterprises competing with each other. We get the capitalist free market, so to speak. That's the concept. It's creativity. It's the spirit that creates everything that we have. Not matter. Not workers in the menial sense of the term. Thank you for listening, everybody. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to
The Orthodox Nationalist
with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson and RadioArian.com.